Chapter 29. Who was blamed? Throughout the month of January, Mr. Simons had led the seminar group slowly through Genesis chapters 4 and 5, discussing every question that was raised. Verity had been thoroughly enjoying the company of Thomas, Emily and Kate, and this Tuesday evening, Peter had come as well. Tonight they were beginning Genesis chapter 6. Mr. Simons had everyone read verses 1 to 8, and then they talked about the events that led up to the Great Flood. Henry put up his hand and asked if the giants in verse 4 were called Nephilim and whether they were the offspring of angels and humans. Understanding what Henry was getting at, Mr. Simons shook his head. He confirmed that the Hebrew word for giant was Nephilim, but pointed out two additional facts. Firstly, he said, in verse 4 it says, there were Nephilim in the earth in those days, before the union of the sons of God and daughters of men. Secondly, the word Nephilim was used again in Numbers 13, verse 33, referring to the giants that intimidated the spies Moses sent out. These giants were certainly not angel-human offspring, because they existed long after the flood destroyed the previous Nephilim. So who were the sons of God? Henry interrupted. Doesn't that refer to angels? Sometimes it does, Mr. Simons agreed. But believers are also called sons of God in Romans chapter 8, verse 14. He reminded everyone that back in Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, when Seth had a son called Enosh, men began to call upon the name of the Lord. This was, Mr. Simons pointed out, the beginning of a distinction between those who worshipped God and those who followed Cain's wicked ways. So these were men, not angels, who married the daughters? Henry asked, wanting further clarification. That's right, Henry. If you read out Matthew chapter 22, verse 30, you will see that this couldn't refer to angels. Henry read the passage. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels of God in heaven. Oh, I see, he said. Angels don't marry. As a group, they then carried on to examine the wickedness described in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. That led to a long discussion on the cause of sin. Mr. Henderson, who always seemed to know what questions would be asked ahead of time, handed out a new study sheet to everyone for homework entitled Satan in the Old Testament. Because Peter was well enough to drive now, he offered to come up to Aunt Judy's on Saturday evening so they could all do the study sheet together. Huddled around the kitchen table with steaming cups of hot chocolate in front of them, they chatted for a bit about their experiences writing exams that week. They were all greatly relieved that the last 3 weeks were over. "Do you think you did okay?" Verity asked Peter. "Thanks to your brother, I think I passed at least 3 of my courses," Peter replied, clapping Thomas on the shoulder. Then, picking up the study sheet, he glanced through it briefly with a sigh. "Every time I do one of these things, I have to re-examine all my basic beliefs," he groaned. "I'd like to be right for once." "Do you want to be right, or do you want to know what's right?" Verity asked teasingly. "Hey," Peter responded with mock indignation. "Is this what I get for hanging around a girl who asks too many questions?" Verity could tell by the look on his face that Peter was only joking, but there seemed to be a strange mix of emotion in his words. She could tell that he was interested in seeing what the Bible had to say, but she sensed that it was becoming a struggle for him to change what he had always believed. Thomas had been sitting back listening to this little interchange. "In some ways," he remarked, a little unsure of himself, "it's probably harder for you to do this study, Peter, because you're sure of your beliefs already. Verity and I never really knew what we believed." Peter nodded with a slight laugh. "Yeah, let's just say I was sure of my beliefs. Anyhow, we should get started." Thomas looked in the concordance and found that in the Old Testament, Satan meant an opponent, an adversary, or to withstand. Looking up the places where Satan was used in Englishman's Hebrew concordance, Peter was very surprised to come across Numbers chapter 22, verse 22. After puzzling silently over the whole context and the verse, he finally said, "This is an interesting one. This is the story of the prophet Balaam, who wanted to prophesy against Israel for money. God said to him that he could only go if the king's men called for him in the morning. Even then, he was only allowed to say what God would tell him to say. Instead of waiting for the men to call him, Balaam got up to go with them anyway. So God was angry and sent an angel to stop him. Now listen to this verse," he said, sounding astonished. "And God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord stood in the way for an adversary against him." Peter looked up. That word adversary is the same word Satan, yet this angel was stopping Balaam from sinning, he remarked. I thought Satan was always used to entice people to sin, not to stop them. That is interesting, Verity remarked, taking note of Peter's reference. So a good angel was being a Satan in a good way. The next reference they looked up was 2 Samuel 19, verse 22. Verity read it. David replied, "What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah? This day you have become my adversaries. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" She thought out loud. That word adversaries is the word Satan. David's nephews were trying to stop David from doing what he thought was right, so being a Satan to someone means opposing what they are doing, whether good or bad. There were several other such passages. Knowing which passage would give everyone difficulty, Mr. Henderson had made a special section dealing with the book of Job. The word Satan occurred at least 14 times in the first two chapters of this book. When Peter saw they were looking at Job, he shook his head. There's got to be a supernatural devil here. The first question on the sheet asked the participant to determine who the sons of God were. After reading Job chapters 1 and 2 to understand the context, they tried to answer the question. Now, Mr. Simon said this could refer to believers, Peter remembered. Maybe these quotes support that. Verity read aloud Hosea 1 verse 10, one of the references given on the study sheet. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it was said to them, "You are not my people," they will be called sons of the living God. Looking up, she remarked, "Here, the sons of God definitely refers to Israel." Looking up the third passage on the study sheet, Thomas read 1 John 3, verses 1 to 3, from the Old King James, and then informed them, "This says, we should be called sons of God now." Peter nodded. All right, in those two places it certainly means believers. Next they looked at what it meant to present themselves before God. I would have thought this meant coming before God in heaven, Peter remarked uncertainly. Thomas liked to do the concordance work. Present means to station, offer, or continue, he read. Verity looked up Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 14. The Lord said to Moses, "Now the day of your death is near. Call Joshua and present yourselves at the tent of meeting where I will commission him." So Moses and Joshua came and presented themselves at the tent of meeting. She grinned at Peter's frowning face. Sorry, Peter. It looks like you can present yourself to God on earth. I guess the next passage will prove the same thing, Peter sighed. But he turned it up anyway. Looking quickly at the context of 1 Samuel chapter 10, verse 19, he said, Okay, Samuel is speaking here, telling the people of Israel off because they asked for a king when God was their king. So he says, "And ye have this day rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your adversities and your tribulations. And ye have said unto him, Nay, but set a king over us. Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands." All right, Peter shrugged. God is telling the tribes of Israel to present themselves to him. So I guess you don't have to be in heaven to present yourself to God. When they looked up the three passages in Job, they discovered that Job always attributed his sufferings to God, never Satan. To further emphasize the point in question number 3, Mr. Henderson has specifically asked them to state who was carrying out the suggestions that Satan was making. When they looked these up, they saw that each one referred to Job's troubles as coming from God's hand. Thomas read the last passage on the sheet, which was Job chapter 42, verse 11. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all they that had been of his acquaintance before, and did eat bread with him in his house. And they bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Every man also gave him a piece of money. Verity noted from the concordance that there weren't any further references to Satan in the book of Job after the first two chapters. Peter sat back trying to sort all this out. If Satan wasn't the red guy with a pitchfork, then who was he? Verity remarked, "Well, he was among the sons of God, so he could have been just a man that believed in God. And if he was presenting himself before God, maybe he was a man that believed in God, coming to worship God," Thomas added. Tilting his head to one side, Peter frowned. So if he was a believer, then why did he want to do such awful things to Job? Maybe he wasn't a very good believer, Thomas offered. That could be, Thomas, Verity nodded. Lots of believers in the Bible had times where they did things that were wrong. Think of David, she suggested. He ended up taking another man's wife and then trying to figure out how to kill the man. It was slowly becoming more plausible to Peter. Okay, he said. So you mean that this Satan was a believer who had a problem with Job? Like maybe he was jealous of him? Verity nodded excitedly, feeling they were onto something. Yes, jealousy might be it, Peter. Remember in chapter 1 God was telling Satan how wonderful Job was? Peter looked skeptical again. That bothers me, he said. God actually talked to this Satan. He paused and considered. But I guess back in the Old Testament God talked to lots of people. Verity could see that Peter was carefully thinking this all through, so she waited to hear what he was going to come up with. Finally, he gave it a try. All right, if Satan can be anyone who tries to oppose someone else, then Satan could have been an enemy of Job's that was jealous of him. He pondered this further. God did talk directly to people in those days, so maybe after their conversations, God carried out the enemy's ideas to show him how faithful Job was. Thomas and Verity nodded enthusiastically. Great summary, Verity praised. As they wrote down what they had figured out onto the study sheet, Verity suddenly remembered something she had read in the New Testament. Remember when Jesus said, "Get behind me, Satan," to Peter? She asked. I guess he was calling Peter Satan because Peter was trying to stop Jesus from doing what was right. A glance at the boys' faces indicated they didn't understand why she was saying this. I always wondered why Jesus would call his own disciples such an awful name, she explained. But Peter was being an adversary to Jesus, so that's why he deserved to be called Satan. Stretching his arms out, Peter confessed, I still have a lot of questions about this, but I must say, with so much time to think lately, it has started to bother me that there could be such a thing as a devil or Satan. If there is a supernatural devil, and he can really do all the things people say he can, then he has powers almost equal to God. He paused, thinking hard. In fact, a devil like that would have to be more powerful than God, as he sure has more people on his side than God does.